Hello listeners, will you allow me a minute to tell you about Past Test? If you haven't used them yet, you should. They are a fantastic online resource with hundreds of questions and answers covering multiple medical exams, including the MRCS, MRCP and medical finals. I've used them lots and found the resource so useful, particularly the past papers for these exams. As a listener to the podcast, you lucky people get 15% off some of these subscriptions. So don't wait around. I mean, do until the end of the episode, but then go and get your access. Links and codes will be in the show notes. But before we get going, I'd also like to tell you about a really great resource that I've used for probably all my exams. It's Teach Me Surgery. It's a website covering all the topics you'd need to know. It's really easy to use and clear to follow. It goes through the topics in a logical and comprehensive manner and always finishes making it clinically relevant. Nearly all the content is free and I'd highly recommend adding it to your regularly used resources. Please find the link in the bio and check it out. Who will a dim bone
drive on? Welcome to MRCS on the Move, Bowels, Bones and Backseat Vibers. I'm your host, Naomi, but this is the podcast where you do the talking. Okay, hello and welcome back to another episode of MRCS on the Move. I hope everyone's well and revision is going great. I'm really excited today to invite two special guests onto the podcast. I have Mr. Marcus Cumberbatch. He's a consultant urologist currently working in Sheffield. I had the pleasure of him doing some of my teaching a couple of months ago. That's how we got in touch. And then with him, I have his co-host from a podcast, which we'll talk about in a moment, Sammy Conroy, who is a clinical research fellow. So hello, welcome to the podcast.
Hi there.
Morning, Naomi. Thanks for having us.
Absolute pleasure. So before we get on to my podcast, I'd love to give these guys an opportunity to talk about a podcast that they have recently started hosting called Top Bunk, Bottom Bunk. So I'll hand over to you guys to sort of say what it's about and tell the listeners why they should listen.
Sure. Well, thanks for the introduction. Of course, it's a trailblazing, dynamic, hilarious podcast with educational content. It's something that was a bit of a pet project that we came up with around April, May time and started launching in September, available on all your usual sources, Spotify and Buzzsprout. And it's something that we really enjoy doing and tackle different topics, sort of a burnout, human factors in surgery, so sort of more ethereal topics around surgery in general, but then also a deep dive on some urological topics such as how to manage stone disease or changes to prostate cancer pathways and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it's something that we really feel it's got education, but also it's something that's easy listening and kind of aimed at really those moments where you're commuting or sitting down looking for something to do at home. So yeah, I don't know, Sammy, if you've got any other thoughts on it.
Well, TBBB stands for Top Bunk, Bottom Bunk podcast. As Marcus said, we came up with it waiting for a flight to go to the APCCC conference. And really it was to try and give the perspective on the topics that Marcus has mentioned from both the kind of consultant level and the trainee level. And that's just to make sure that we're kind of encapsulating both things, so i.e. consultant top bunk and trainee on the bottom bunk.
Is that what that means? I wasn't 100% sure. So
for everyone who wondered, we're not just spending lots of time at Dunnell Mill. We did actually have a reason for calling it.
I had a Twitter kind of direct message the other day saying, gosh, I hadn't listened to your podcast because I thought it was all about transperineal prostate biopsy. But now that I've actually listened to it, I realise it's about much, much more. And I was like, oh man, maybe we've made a big faux pas there. I think we're getting over the line.
Yeah, no, I mean, I definitely recommend it. And it's, to people, all surgeons, really, because the topics are really quite broad. They're not urology, just urology based, are they? So
That's it. And, you know, we tried to interview some general surgeons. We've got a max vac surgeon coming on next week. You know, it's something that is, I think, broad. And, you know, even the urological sort of themed ones could be applied to other specialties just with a different title. You know, because some of it's about infrastructure, but also about managing your career. So we talk about fellowships and things like that, which I think would always be in information giving to a higher level surgical trainee. So thanks for the pitch.
Oh, it's all right. It's all right. Maybe mention me on yours at some point.
We will, and we'll definitely have you on.
Eye for an eye.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll come up with a good theme and get you on there for sure.
Fab. So I'll put a link in the show notes as well, so you can go and find that if you want to afterwards. Today we're going to sort of touch on the topic of renal cell carcinoma. So this is a huge, huge topic, but I think we're going to try and just pick up the questions that are most relevant to the MRCS. Okay, so we'll crack on with the first question. Can you tell me a bit about the epidemiology of kidney cancer?
Yeah, totally. So it's a common cancer. It's about the 16th most common cancer worldwide, but actually its incidence is increasing due to increasing scanning, basically incidentalomas. It's about 3% lifetime. Sorry, 3% of cancers are renal cancers, and it's got a preponderance to men over females of about a ratio of 1.5 to 1. Chief incidence roughly 50 to 70 years of age, and there are some risk factors, which I'm sure you'll come on to, which increase the preponderance for it. It seems to be a disease of westernized nations, and partly I think that's due to, again, those risk factors, so carcinogen exposure, environmental factors, and in particular certain parts of Eastern Europe. In terms of risk factors...
I'm going to stop you. Don't give away the answer. We all know you know it. cool, great, thank you. So then next question, not quite risk factors, but what is the basic pathology of kidney cancer?
So it's really interesting. I guess our advances in understanding of the molecular biology of the disease have obviously dramatically increased over the last kind of 20, 30 years. We think that actually a lot of most RCCs are sporadic, and actually 75% of them have at least one mutation in what's called the VHL gene. So it's the von Hippel-Lindau gene. Now, this is an important regulator of hypoxia within cells. And actually, when it gets inactivated by the mutations in RCC, it can lead to accumulation of hypoxia-related factors, which can then cause mitogenesis. And actually, what usually happens in RCC is you get an increased blood supply to that area, so angiogenic factors. So this is why we commonly get mutations in the VEGF pathway, so VEGF, and also things like the platelet-derived growth factor pathway. It also then leads to kind of downstream signal transduction. So again, common things in the RAS-RAF-MEK pathway or the PIK3 pathway and mTOR pathways. So things like everolimus back in the day, which is an mTOR inhibitor, was commonly used to treat patients with RCC who had metastatic disease. And then obviously we've got the evolving role of the immune system. Now this is something that's probably going to expand over the next kind of 10 years as we've delved into immunotherapy use. So I won't go into that too much, but certainly there's an immunogenic role in the pathology of RCC.
Fab. Extremely comprehensive answer. Thank you, Sammy. Again, along the pathology lines, but what different types of kidney cancer do you know, and which one do you think is the most common?
So there are a number of different subtypes. The first thing to say is that the kidney as an organ can be affected by renal cell carcinoma or upper tract urothelial cancers, and 90% of cancers to the kidney are renal cell cancers. So that's the main differential there. Amongst that cohort of cancers, the commonest is clear cell renal carcinoma. There are papillary type cancers, which are subclassified into types 1 and 2. And then there are the rarer types, which are chromophobe and collecting duct renal carcinomas.
So what are the risk factors for an RCC?
Yep, so there's classically a triad of risk factors, which is cigarette smoking, obesity, and hypertension. And as Sammy alluded to earlier with the pathology, the thought process behind smoking is free radical formation and also hypoxia to cells, as with obesity and hypertension, because as you can imagine, if cells are under are under stress from abnormalities in the oxygen delivery and blood supply to tissue, then that can create these hypoxic conditions. There are some associations with first degree relatives having been affected, and although it's not an exogenous risk factor, it is a risk factor in the global sense, and actually around 5 to 8% of kidney cancers have a familial component, which is probably underplayed in clinical practice.
I've just got written here patients on dialysis. Would you say that is as well?
There is an increase, maybe even as high as 3 or 4-fold, if you're on dialysis of having cancer in your native kidney. I suspect that's due to an immunosuppressive effect. And anecdotally, you do see it, although not all that commonly.
Okay.
And I wonder if that's just because they have so many other issues that it's maybe just not detected, or it's, you know, often those kidneys are so cystic that it's very difficult to determine that they've got a malignancy there. And perhaps it's only when they get removed due to other factors like, space occupying effects and things like that, or bleeding, that they then under the microscope you find an occult occult cancer.
I guess the other thing is that you can't do the kind of gold standard imaging with contrast, because patients obviously have terrible renal function, so those are probably the reasons why we don't see it as much as you'd anticipate to.
Yeah, great. Okay, so we've alluded to a few of these hereditary conditions, but do you want to just tell us about some of the hereditary conditions that are associated with renal cell carcinomas?
Yes, it's estimated that about 4 to 5% of kidney cancers are hereditary. Like Marcus said, that's probably underplayed a lot in the way that we construct our histories, and the fact that we rely so much on cross-sectional imaging. I guess you should always really consider hereditary condition in the context of kidney cancer when you've got bilateral disease, multifocal disease, or if the patient's really young, so typically below the age of 45, 46, you'd be considering kind of a hereditary or genetic component. So the most common one, I've mentioned the factor earlier on, but the most common hereditary condition is von Hippel-Lindau syndrome. So about 40 to 60% of these patients will develop RCC in their lifetime. It typically presents bilaterally, and it's an autosomal dominant gene, which mutates the VHL tumor suppressor gene. So then you get inactivation, as I mentioned in the biology. There's several other hereditary syndromes that I won't mention. The other one, which can affect kind of younger people, are tuberous sclerosis. That's the TSC1 and TSC2 genes. So those are things where you'd get a much more syndromic picture, and you'd be looking for kidney cancers within that syndrome rather than as a first presentation, I imagine.
Great. Okay, so moving on to some of the slightly more clinical questions. How do RCCs commonly present?
So
Oh.
So kidney cancer is a disease of triads, as mentioned in the risk factors, Naomi. So the classic textbooks would tell you that a patient would present with a loin mass, loin pain, and visible hematuria. But the chances of that happening are diminishing because you can imagine you'd have to have a fairly florid disease for that to present in that way. And we're detecting more and more things on cross-sectional imaging. And so we're stage migrating the disease a little bit by picking things up on imaging. Rather than presenting when patients are in extremis. But nonetheless, if you have a mass in the loin with hematuria, chances are you might have a renal cancer. Other ways are detected through hematuria clinics, detected through the GP consultations or self-presentation of patients to A&E, and that is with dipstick hematuria. So 1+ or more of blood on the dipstick is significant. Ideally, in the absence of other causes such as infection, and those patients will be referred to a 2-week wait clinic if they fit the NICE guidance, which is either visible hematuria over the age of 45 or over 60 with non-visible hematuria and either painful passing of urine, so dysuria, or raised white cell count. So those patients will come into a 2-week wait clinic and they'll be assessed where they'll have imaging of their kidneys as well as a flexible cystoscopy of their bladder. And so we're seeing a lot of kidney cancers coming in through that way. And by far, I would say most cancers present through that route as a fast track clinic.
How many is there a percentage of how many patients with microscopic hematuria would have a kidney cancer? Would you find to have one?
Good question. So the studies out of North America and interestingly Leeds, so Ed Messing in America. Dr. Mr. Britton in the UK showed that you get about 5% pickup of a pathology if you have non-visible hematuria, and of that 5%, so 4%, so 80% of that 5% have a malignant cause potentially. And kidney cancer is a small proportion of that compared to bladder cancer, but it's probably in the region of about 1-2%. So I guess the answer to your question. The direct answer to your question is probably about 1-2% of patients presenting with non-visible hematuria might have kidney cancer, but that's probably an overestimate. I think that's probably a slight overestimation.
I mean, it's worth also considering the other risk factors. If you've got an 80-year-old with no other conditions, who's not on any medication with non-visible hematuria that's persistent, then their chance of malignancy would be higher than a 30-year-old patient who has had multiple UTIs in the past, for example.
Yeah.
So it's worth considering all the other kind of competing factors that would contribute to a urological malignancy in that sense.
Yeah, definitely. Great. I've just written here as well, so just to consider, people might present with those metastatic symptoms as well, and sort of bone pain, cough, weight loss, fatigue, those sorts of things as well.
Yeah, totally.
So what are neoplastic syndromes or symptoms is one question, and then specifically with RCC, which ones do we find with in RCCs?
So I guess, I didn't look up the specific definition before I came, but I imagine kind of paraneoplastic syndrome is either related to the metabolic consequences of a tumour. So that might be the factors that are released by a tumour into circulation, or it might be relation to the metabolic complications of metastases, for example. Mm-hmm. So actually about 10 to 40% of patients with kidney cancer present with paraneoplastic syndromes at the outset, most likely related to metastatic disease. Mm-hmm. And actually the typical ones in RCC are hypocalcemia, which can be related to lytic bone breakdown, polycythemia, which is increase in your hemoglobin, and then the other one is hypertension. So again, these are related to more so the factors released by the actual tumour itself, and it's related to the tumour biology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. Thank you. Okay, so now we're moving on to a clinic scenario. So I'm a registrar in clinic with Mr. Cumberbatch, and my next patient's referred from the colorectal surgeons. It's a patient who had an ultrasound for some right upper quadrant pain, and it's shown about a 7 centimeter mass in the kidney, and they referred them on to your 2 week wait clinic. So what would you be expecting me as the registrar in clinic to ask in my history?
So this is not uncommon, and you've got a great heads up here because you've got imaging, so it's showing you know the disease at hand. It's a bit like being an orthopedic surgeon. You've got a fracture on a scan, so it's kind of you're backpedaling to find out, you know, how it all came about and maybe how long it's been there for, and to some extent you're trying to work out how fit that patient is for ongoing treatment. But to go back to brass tacks, you know, you're just taking a genetic history. You want to find out, you know, has the patient been symptomatic? If so, what symptoms? Have they had pain, blood in the urine? Have they lost weight? Give you an idea of how likely it is that they've got maybe metastases. You want to know any competing comorbidities that might influence the way you either image that patient for further staging or treat them. So, you know, have you got diabetes? Have you got something like a chest condition that might influence your ability to have an anaesthetic? You also want to know, are they on medication, in particular things like anticoagulants, nephrotoxic medications, things that might suppress the immune system. You want to know social history. Are they a smoker? If so, they need to stop kind of very quickly. It's going to promote the disease. Are they overweight? Is it something that you need to tackle before they'd be suitable for an operation? You want to examine them. Do they have the classic mass? Or are there any other signs of occult metastasis, cachexia, etc.? And then really you're looking at moving on, I think, to how am I going to fully stage this patient, and working them up for an MDT discussion.
Mm-hmm. Fabulous. Yeah. One note I made was maybe a good question for the audience is, why might you want to examine this? It's probably the wrong side, but why might you want to examine the testicles in a patient? Maybe they've presented with just flank pain or they've got a mass. Why might we examine the testicles?
It's a good question.
Oh, you didn't leave long enough there. That was deliberately a question to the audience.
You're so eager, Marcus.
It is a bit unnatural, I'll give you that. You're not the first guest who's struggled with it. Go for it. Fire away.
So some patients will present with a varicocele when they have a renal mass. So they'll have the bag of worms in their hemiscrotum due to congestion of the venous outflow from the scrotum to the cava, and on the left side in particular, the gonadal vein drains to the left renal vein as opposed to straight into the cava, which it does on the right hand side. So if you have a renal malignancy, in particular if you have renal vein involvement from that malignancy, you can get venous congestion down the gonadal into the hemiscrotum and get a varicocele. Mm-hmm. So sometimes the way that these cancers are detected is that a patient has gone in with a scrotal mass, and then part of the protocol for ultrasounding a testis with the clinical question of query varicocele is that they will get an ultrasound of their kidneys. So sonographers will quite often, as a default, do a quick scan of the kidneys if they find a varicocele to make sure there isn't a culpable renal mass. Mm-hmm. If you've already got demonstration of a renal mass, I wouldn't go hunting for a varicocele necessarily. Yeah. Although, clearly, if you want to be very thorough and in an exam, that might be a good thing to do. But in clinical practice, your scan will tell you whether the vein's involved or not.
Yeah. Great. Okay, so we've touched on the next steps are going to be to further investigate and stage this patient. So what are the initial investigations we're going to request for this patient?
Yeah, so I mean, really, we're trying to, if we've established that this patient is for surgery or if they've got metastatic disease, we ideally want to get some routine blood tests. So obviously, with a full blood count, you're looking for evidence of anemia or polycythemia, like we've mentioned in the paraneoplastic syndrome section. You want to really get a good idea of their baseline renal function and their, you know, glomerular filtration rate. We probably want to do liver function. Sometimes with aggressive renal tumours, you can get release of interleukins that cause congestion within the liver and can offset your liver function tests. I can't remember the name, go on, Marcus.
Stauffer syndrome.
There's one for me. other things, again, so looking at clotting studies, group and save, in preparation for surgery. And then a calcium profile is another one, just to make sure that you don't have evidence of hypercalcemia.
Yeah.
I mean, like Marcus said, we're kind of really teeing these patients up to be fully staged. Mm-hmm. Typically, to fully stage the renal tumour itself, you use a triple phase CT scan of the kidneys, unless there's an allergy, the patient's pregnant, or there's another contraindication to doing so, for example, poor renal function. And then you want to do you're going to do a thorax as well to make sure that they don't have lung metastases, which are very common in renal cell carcinoma. Alternatively, you know, the other things you might want to do to work them up is, if, particularly if they've got aggressive disease involving the vein or the caver, is that you might want to do an MRI of that area, which allows you to better explore the extent of that either tumour thrombus or tumour invasion. And then in patients with really bad renal function where we don't know the split function, sometimes there's a rule for DMSA or, you know, MAG3 if there's obstruction on one side. So those are the things that we typically do to kind of investigate the patient. Obviously, next comes the anaesthetic workups, if there's any other anaesthetic concerns, pulmonary function tests, CPETs, etc., to make sure the patient's fit enough. Because often, like we mentioned, these patients may be overweight, old, smokers, in which case you need to make sure that they're actually fit enough for the anaesthetic side of things. These are big operations, particularly the open operations, and so we need to make sure that it's not at greater risk for the patient.
Yeah, perfect. Great. So when might we do a biopsy? What do we do them typically? And if not, when might we consider it?
Yeah, so that's a controversial topic. The actual performance of a biopsy is a safe procedure, and the yield is very good. Specificity and sensitivity of that procedure are very good, and anyone who wants to become a urologist can read a paper by Lorenzo Marconi on that, who did a meta-analysis showing that it's a safe and accurate procedure. The issue is it necessary? And there is a slight false negative rate. Patients who really benefit from this are the ones who've got multiple tumours, and you're looking at nephron-sparing approaches to their care. Do they need full nephrectomies? Do they need partial nephrectomies or ablative procedures? And, you know, trying to sequence their treatment appropriately. Patients, likewise, imperative indications for kind of being extra cautious are if they've got a solitary kidney, and the stakes are that little bit higher. You want to kind of get that little bit more information that they have definite cancer before you tackle such a case. Patients who are considering surveillance as an option, and perhaps there's just a hint that things might look a bit more aggressive, and you're thinking, is surveillance really the right thing? You might want to confirm. If they're having an ablative procedure where tissue is going to become unavailable after the treatment, then you would like to get a biopsy. In fact, I'd almost mandate a biopsy before any ablative treatment, because otherwise, if it recurs, then you're not going to have anything to base your systemic therapy on or your future treatment. And then I think sometimes if you've got a small renal mass and patients are, as I say, a bit ambivalent, some colleagues would just go for it before doing things like a partial nephrectomy, just to give them that little bit of confidence that the patient might just to tip the patient into an operation, basically. But by no means is it imperative in that circumstance, and I think that it becomes a patient choice matter. And some centres do biopsies all the time, some centres don't do very many. And one of the negatives of having a biopsy, apart from the fact that a negative result doesn't always mean you definitely don't have a cancer, is that the operation can become a little bit more tricky if they've had a biopsy, because the tissue interfaces can become a little bit stickier, the planes can be slightly disrupted, you could potentially hemorrhage into the kidney. And there isn't a completely zero risk of actually losing a kidney through a biopsy, so patients have to be consented appropriately for that.
You mentioned about active surveillance. I always think the guidelines sort of imply that anyone who has active surveillance has to have a biopsy. Would you not agree with that? Would it just be people who you might think, more like you said, would be more aggressive? Or is it that anyone who's going to be on surveillance should technically have one? Does that question make sense? No, you can just answer that straight away. That's not, that one's for you.
So you're right, the guidelines do say that. Or at least it's worded in a way that makes you think that they want you to biopsy every patient. That is not, I don't think, good practice, because actually imaging is so good, especially if they can have a triple phase CT scan, and comparing like for like imaging over 6 monthly intervals or yearly intervals is, I think, kosher. And you're just looking for that size increase. And you can get an idea of if something's metabolically active, if it's likely to be malignant, based on how vascular it is, its architecture, and whether it's growing or not. And I think you can make your decisions based on that.
I wonder what the cost implications and the infrastructure implications would be of biopsying every single patient with a small renal mass who's on surveillance. Yeah. I imagine it would be enormous.
Huge.
And not an insignificant cost to patients. Biopsy can go wrong. There's risks associated with biopsy. They may have to travel quite a distance to get to a centre that provides biopsy. It can be painful. It can be quite traumatising for patients having a biopsy. So really, you're thinking about what you are getting in terms of benefit from the biopsy compared to the availability and the risk to patients. So I think there's more to be weighed up than biopsying everyone. I don't imagine in the NHS we'd be able to biopsy everyone anyway, because it would be so expensive, time-consuming.
Yeah, definitely.
And we don't have the resources to do so.
The final instance, I mean, Sammy, you're completely right there. The final instance where a biopsy is mandatory, really, is if they've got de novo metastatic disease, because you can't get licensing for certain medications for systemic therapy without a histological diagnosis beyond the very sort of entry-level tyrosine kinase inhibitors. So, I think those large targets. And the other reason not to biopsy is if it's a cystic lesion. So if they've got a cystic mass where you can't target a solid component of that cystic mass, then you shouldn't be having a biopsy because the patient will explode. No, joking. It's hard to get tissue.
They wouldn't do cytology. This maybe just a random question. You couldn't do cytology on the fluid from a cyst.
Yeah, good question. I'm not even sure I've ever heard anyone discuss that. I suspect you probably could do. I guess the concern with all of these things is seeding and whether or not by aspirating a malignant mass you would distort the anatomy. I don't know. Yeah, it's a good question. There you go. MD thesis.
Maybe not. Okay, moving on from biopsies. As we said, a controversial topic. But so how are RCCs staged? What system do we use to stage them? Every little detail, Sammy, I need every point.
You actually?
No, it's fine. Go on.
Yeah, so thanks for dropping me in that question. So it's really interesting, I guess, because like we've mentioned, with the increased incidence of cross-sectional imaging, we typically use radiological staging in the first instance. So we'd look at things like tumour size, local invasion, either within or beyond Grotthus fascia, which is the fascial lining around the kidney, whether it involves the renal vein or whether it involves the inferior vena cava, and then looking at the other contributors of staging, which include nodal involvement and then metastases. So you should get a TNM staging criteria. So stage one tumours, it's split 1 to 4 in terms of generalised staging. So stage one would be T1N0, which would be usually a tumour less than 7 centimetres with another significant factors. Stage two would be T2N0, Stage three would be T3 and above, or any other tumour stage with an N positive, so N1.
Yeah.
And then stage four is either T4 tumours or those with metastases at, like Marcus mentioned, at de novo presentation.
Yeah.
So those are the 1 to 4 stages, which obviously includes those multiple factors. I guess then the other thing that we use when we remove the kidney are the histological parameters. So historically, that's been the Furman grading classification system, but more recently has been kind of upgraded with the WHO ISUP system, which is used for clear cell and papillary RCCs. And this uses a combination of histological factors, including nuclear prominence, pleomorphism, giant cells, and then the presence or absence of sarcomatoid differentiation. Other macroscopic factors that you might see in histology reports include things like areas of hematoma, evidence of necrosis, and then other things like lymphovascular invasion that may be kind of negative predictive factors for that patient. But typically it's the TNM staging that will do most things for us. I don't know if you want to speak a little bit about the risk.
The only other thing that influences me in the post-operative management of these patients is the Mayo risk score. So I think another synonym for it is the Leibovitz score. But this classifies patients to low, intermediate and high risk based on some of the features Sammy's mentioned, in terms of necrosis, size of tumour, presence of sarcomatoid features. And if the patient is high risk or intermediate risk, they might be eligible for both trials but also adjuvant treatment. Actually, NICE has just approved a immunotherapy for high risk tumours adjuvantly to reduce recurrence. And so more and more we're being asked to label patients with their Mayo risk score after they've had a nephrectomy.
I guess the only other thing to mention is that not all renal tumours are solid, so not all tumours that present will be a solid mass, in which case we can use the, if they're cystic, for example, we can use the, you might have heard of the Bosniak classification system for cystic tumours, which is stage 1, 2, 2F, 3 and 4. And basically, depending on your Bosniak classification, it can stratify your risk of that cyst being malignant.
Yeah.
And that may allow us to kind of counsel patients or, you know, discuss surgery with patients who may be at a higher risk of developing malignancy within that cyst.
Yeah. Great. Quite a big question now, but how do we manage / treat patients with renal cell carcinomas?
Yeah, so a very broad question. I guess this is the core of what we're talking about, though, isn't it? Mm. So first of all, the patient is diagnosed as a possible renal cancer. They then would go to an MDT where that is confirmed, or at least the steps to confirmation are kind of thought through. And then it's about what size of tumour it is, the context, you know, of the patient. Like I mentioned earlier, single kidney, multiple disease, etc. So you've got to try and put the patient into a category of, is it a small renal mass? Is it a large renal mass? Is it a particularly complex situation? And assuming that they've got localized disease after full staging and they're fit for any option, then the options available would include, for a small renal mass, which is considered to be a mass under 3 centimeters or at least under 4 centimeters, so essentially a T1 tumor, would be surveillance. It would be ablative procedures, and in the NHS, most of those are either radiofrequency ablation or cryoablation, so microwaves or freezing, or a surgical approach. And the gold standard, really, for a small renal mass would be a partial nephrectomy, which is done either robotically or using an open technique. Mm-hmm. If the patient has a larger tumour, then they might be heading towards a radical nephrectomy or a very difficult partial nephrectomy. And that can be done either, again, on the robot, potentially laparoscopically if it's a full nephrectomy, or open. And then in the metastatic setting, you're looking at systemic therapies. So very much, the answer to your question is, it really depends on the cards you're dealt in terms of the size, location, and patient factors.
Yeah. Perfect. Sorry, very broad, big question. So we're nearly there. I think we've touched slightly on it, but we'll just end on a bit more specific treatment options, which a couple of them have come up kind of in conversation for the metastatic renal cell carcinoma. So what audience do you think are broadly the options patients have? Go for it.
Like Marcus mentioned earlier, de novo presentation of metastatic RCC is actually quite common. So about 13 to 15% of all patients with diagnosed with renal cell carcinoma will present with metastatic disease. So obviously the reason being is that they're very vascular tumours. They can spread by hematogenous means, and patients often end up with typically lung or bone metastases are the most common. So this isn't an uncommon scenario. Again, when we're thinking about treatment options, you have to think about, you know, patient factors. So what's their performance status? Are they fit enough mm-hmm. for the therapies that we're potentially going to give them? You have to think about your institution factors. So have you got a good working relationship with your oncologist? Can you refer patients early? And what treatment options are they delivering? Are they delivering kind of novel edge-cutting clinical trials, or are they not? And are we giving things as per kind of a NICE guidance, which can be quite tricky with the kind of newer immunotherapies just because they're so expensive. And then I guess you've got the other option, which is if you have an unfit patient, you've got the option for watchful waiting and symptomatic treatment. So it's all really thinking about who you've got in front of you and what you've got available at your institution. In terms of the landscape of systemic therapies, we've obviously had huge changes, particularly in RCC, in the last kind of 10 to 15 years. If you look back 20 years ago, we were giving interferon therapies and tyrosine kinase inhibitors. So these are targeted therapies, which had kind of widespread side effect profiles and were quite toxic to patients. And in the last 10 years, we've understood the disease biology better. We understand there's a huge kind of immunogenic component to RCC. And therefore, there's been an expanse in the number of treatments available to patients, so particularly immunotherapies. And actually, there's been about 15 new therapies, approved by NICE for metastatic renal cell carcinoma in fit patients in about the last 10 years. I don't know whether it is actually 15, but there's been a lot of them. So maybe if we think about some of those, so you've got things like, and typically we don't just give single therapies now, so there's been quite a few trials, so Keynote, Checkmate trials that have shown that dual therapy, either immuno-immuno or immuno-targeted, actually give better longevity of results and improve survival. Mm-hmm. So typically we're hitting patients up front with dual therapy involving an immunotherapy in the first instance, unless there's a contraindication to do so. Mm-hmm. And because we've had so many new treatments available over the last 10 years, actually, if a patient progresses on one treatment, there's actually usually several lines of subsequent therapy, although the stratification of those treatments is still up in the air. And actually, there may be a rationale within trials for repeat biopsy mm. after failing the first line of therapy. And the other option is obviously we've got the option of cytoreductive nephrectomy, which Marcus, you might want to speak a little bit about.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Sammy. Very comprehensive. I think it's a sequencing, isn't it, of systemic therapy, which is kind of not understudied, but maybe uncertain. And I think that's where there's still some research need. In terms of cytoreductive nephrectomy, then, it used to be very popular, again, going back historically 10, 20 years, probably up until about 5-6 years ago. We were doing them routinely, really, for any patient that was fit enough where the primary tumour in particular was, you know, large and burdensome, or if there was visible hematuria, clot colic, that sort of thing. But there were two studies, both under-recruited and underpowered, therefore, but a study called the Carmina trial and one called Sertime, which basically showed that a cytoreductive nephrectomy was not superior to starting systemic therapy straight away. And actually, time to systemic therapy from diagnosis was critical. So the earlier you gave it, the better patients did. And so there was a complete switch around in the literature and in the way that we behaved as urologists and oncologists, where we were offering these patients upfront tyrosine kinase inhibitors and now more immunotherapy straight away. And then if they did well, they were getting assigned to a reductive nephrectomy in a deferred sense. The literature kind of goes and swings around about really now, and now people kind of are reaching a consensus that, well, it should be taken on a case-by-case basis. And if somebody has a low MET burden to primary burden, so if the ratio of METs to primary is favourable and the patient's fit, assigned to reductive nephrectomy, as long as it doesn't delay significantly their recovery to have systemic therapy, it's probably still completely reasonable to do, and in particular if they're a symptomatic patient. You can just imagine that some patients very much want to get rid of the majority of their cancer macroscopically. They are asking for an operation, and I think it's wrong to deprive those patients of that approach. But what you don't want to do is incapacitate that patient for such a long time that they miss the their significant delay with systemic therapy, which is really the thing that's going to harness their metastatic burden. The final point I would make on that, because I know we've answered that question for a long time, but the final part I mentioned is renal cancer is one of those cancers that does very well to metastasis excision. So sometimes, you know, it seems like a patient has missed the boat, they've got mets, you know, even in the chest. But if you do a nephrectomy and take out those lung mets, some patients actually get a complete response, and that can be long lasting. So it is sometimes worth thinking of a sort of total surgical approach for these patients.
I have a really, just from a biological perspective, I have quite a different view maybe on this. I mean, you know, you imagine you've got a patient with a 15 centimeter renal tumor. Now, not all areas of that tumor are going to be biologically the same. And if kind of part of that tumor has released a load of metastases and you treat it with immunotherapy, there's another part of that tumor that remains in the patient that may not be responsive to immunotherapy, that may continue to throw off metastases and drive progression and, you know, worsening survival. Now, it's not something that's it's not been answered. It's something that we are, you know, potentially going to look into here. But I think that particularly with larger and obviously heterogeneous tumors, I find the concept of giving them one treatment and one treatment only, you know, quite unusual. I guess, in prostate cancer, we irradiate the primary when we've got patients progressing with metastatic disease. Why are we not treating the primaries in things like bladder cancer and renal cancer? Because the kind of theory of it is very similar. But anyway, that's just from a biological perspective and something that we might look into.
Great, exciting. Fab, I think that's it. I think we've covered most things. Yeah, that was really great. Thank you so much for coming on. I'm sure the listeners will all really enjoy that and find it really, really useful. So thank you very much. And I will be back with you guys very soon for another exciting topic.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Oh, well, a dim